Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
Today we're lucky to be joined by the head indoor coach at the University of Washington, Keegan Cook. Keegan, thanks for joining us.
John, Billy, thanks for having me. Good to talk with you guys.
So today our topic for the show is about how to be a great assistant coach. And I know you've assisted at some really great programs through the years. So I was wondering what some of the things are that you focused on as an assistant coach.
Man, big question. I'm going back into my memory a little bit to try and remember.
Been a couple of years, I know.
Maybe the first thing that I think about as an assistant is just trying to go into a situation, really trying to understand the program that you're joining and what they value from a core value standpoint and from a volleyball standpoint. But then also making sure that you're identifying kind of maybe an area of weakness where you think you're going to go for it and try and make an impact on that program. And so I'm thinking back to when I was fortunate enough to join Washington for Jim McLaughlin. And the first thing I did was watch every match of their Pac-12 season from 2012. And from start to finish, I think I actually ended up data volley coding all of them, just because when I did that, I really thought that I, you know, had a really complete view of it, and just tried to just get a real clear understanding of what Jim valued without having to ask him. So then maybe that was the first thing that I started with, is before I came in there guns blazing trying to change things or give my ideas, just as quickly and as thoroughly as possible have an understanding of what I was joining.
And just from
that's a big undertaking. Sorry, go ahead, Billy.
No, so just from watching the video, like, I guess, what did you get out of that you saw as like his team values?
Yeah, I think right away what you see or what I saw back in 2012 was a team that was just so fundamentally sound in their movements. You know, extremely efficient, really repeatable. From match to match, environment to environment, you just saw these really consistent movements, especially in the blocking and attacking phases of the game, just across the board from every athlete. You know, just the way they moved in unison, you could just tell that had to be something. It doesn't just happen, you know, as you know. It has to be something that the team values. Passing, you know, you could tell that was a priority, just really simple. And again, fundamentally sound passers looking alike in terms of how they move. And I mean, there were a lot of things, of course, that impressed me in that first time watching Washington, you know, really closely. And then there were a couple areas that I thought, okay, maybe there's some room where I can help or at least, you know, make a slight improvement this next upcoming season.
And then as coming into a program and, you know, having a coach like Jim, was he open to hearing about those weaknesses, or how do you approach kind of letting a head coach know about these things?
Yeah, I think it's funny. I'm trying to think back to that time, and man, Jim sure gave me a lot of rope to hang myself with. he really allowed me to spend a lot of time with the servers in the gym and to bring some ideas on middle attacking. And I think he knew that I just really wanted Washington to be great. They had an outstanding team, you know, in 2013, ended up going to the Final Four. And boy, I didn't want to screw it up, you know, and I hope, you know, that I think he sensed that and saw that I was kind of in there working. But for an assistant going into that situation, I think now being on the other side of it, it's just so easy to point out things that aren't going well for a team, you know, to watch some film and to get an idea and get fired up about it and run into the office and say, hey, look what I found. We need to be better at this. And here's my idea. And I think more assistants need to try and change less, but change it, you know, for the better and focus on it every single day. You know, there's nothing more frustrating as a coach than to have someone come in with an idea and you go for it. And then 2 weeks later, they forget all about it and they're on to the next thing, you know, and just, if you want to make an impact in an area, it has to be day to day and you have to follow through on it. And that would be my biggest suggestion to an assistant coach, you know, now being on the other side of it. Just, hey, I'm with you. If you're fired up on this idea, go for it, but see it all the way through, you know, and own it and know that, you know, you gotta deliver on it.
Nice. And you mentioned Jim McLaughlin, and you also worked under Rob Browning. What were some things that you learned from them and that you've brought with you to your program now?
With Rob, maybe one of the biggest things I learned is you don't turn down help from people who are passionate about helping your program. You know, I think there were times when people would walk into our gym at St. Mary's and say, hey, I want to help. And Rob would say, okay, here you go. Here's your job, you know, however small it was. And I would sometimes look at him like, who is this guy? You know, he's shagging balls. We don't know him. And Rob would just kind of say yes to people who expressed an interest in joining his program. And I think back to how I started my career. I was a sophomore in college, and at St. Mary's, Rob had just gotten the job. And I played a little bit of club volleyball and knew some players on the team. And they mentioned to Rob that I might be able to spend some time with the program. So I walked in the office. He said, yeah, here's this laptop, this program on it. It's called Data Volley. I'm going to go now, figure it out, you know. And that's how it all began for me. And so I've tried to carry that through with my program now. I have the ability to hire people for different positions, and it makes such an impact. You are so much more than just your own abilities as a coach. You know, the number of people that you hire, how well you develop them, how much time you invest them, it just magnifies, you know, your own strengths. And so I think that's been one of the greatest things that Rob taught me is, hey, get people on board, good people, and spend time with them and give them responsibilities, and they'll really help you out.
And then what about from Jim? Were there any big lessons from him?
There's tons of lessons. The first one that I think about with Jim is just this open door policy in his gym. You know, I mean, literally the gym doors are open and people from all over the country, sometimes all over the world, would be coming in to watch practice, and they would spend time in Jim's office. They wouldn't sit kind of in, you know, a general team space. They would sit in Jim's office and he would talk with them and hear their stories and spend time with them. And everyone was always welcome. And, you know, just that idea of being open and allowing information to move in and out of your program is something that I've tried to keep going. You know, I've got lots of people that I've met, lots of ideas I've picked up from people outside of our program. And so that's maybe the first thing that comes to mind, you know, when I think about, you know, what I observed with Jim and running his program.
Some pretty great mentors you got to have. It's pretty cool. So now as a head coach, what are some of the qualities you look for when you're hiring an assistant coach?
Yeah, good question. What do I look for? I really believe that skills can be taught, and you know, pretty much any skill. You know, you're never really prepared for the job that you don't have is something that I believe. You know, you could have an assistant coach who was great at one school, and then you bring them into your organization, and it just doesn't necessarily really work. I think every job is unique in what it requires. So really try and find people who have high character. And one of my favorite things to do is to call, you know, not just one or two references, but 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 people who know the person that you're trying to hire, and just listen to what they say. And I'm not necessarily trying to hear exactly what they're saying, but what I'm hoping is that they all say the same thing. If everybody that this person has met the same person, to me, I think that's a really good sign, you know, that they treat every person that they run into, no matter whether it's Karch Karai or some fan off the street who's interacting with them, they treat them with, you know, a similar level of respect. And I think that says a lot about somebody, and some of the best people I know kind of live their lives that way.
So you were saying earlier that as an assistant coach coming in, you try to figure out what is the program value. So now as a head coach, what are some things that you value that assistant coaches come in and go, those are the core values of this program?
Yeah. I'm sure, you know, usually I get that question about what do you value for your players, not so much with your staff. So it's good to hear that. I have come to really value candor. You know, I think candor, the willingness to tell somebody a hard truth is just so valuable. And I think back to a great assistant coach who I had, Jonathan Winder, and I tell this story a lot. In my second season here as a head coach at Washington, we were, you know, in the second half of Pac-12 play in a really tight race with Stanford and UCLA, I believe, for a Pac-12 title. And we were week in, week out, separated by a game or tied. And I certainly was feeling the pressure to try and win another Pac-12 title. And so a lot of my coaching became focused strictly on results and standards and stats, and we need to meet these standards, and you've got to make that play, and a lot of just result-oriented as opposed to process-oriented feedback. And, you know, Jonathan walked in one day and after a particularly tough practice, and he's kind of pacing around my office and trying to get a point across. I said, "Jonathan, what's up?" And he said, "Hey, I've played for a lot of coaches all over the world, and I've played with coaches who are coaching like you're coaching right now. And I'll tell you right now, I would not want to play for you right now." And when Jonathan Winder tells you that he wouldn't want to play for you right now, it's not a problem with Jonathan Winder. It's a problem with you. You know, and the needle on the record player kind of stopped. You know, it's kind of one of those moments, and it's like there's some silence. And I think I looked in and I said, "Yeah, I got it. I'll see you tomorrow." And, you know, walked out to my car and did some lonely work on just what I was doing, and might have, you know, turned things around for us in terms of how I coached the last few weeks of that season.
Can you let us know what are some of the things you did?
What did I change in my coaching behavior?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think just a lot less conversation, like I said, about standards and results, a lot less conversation about I'm trying to think back to that time. I was very inflexible with, you know, mistakes that players were making, and it wasn't about learning as much as it was about performing right now. And, you know, I think in a certain way I was violating one of my own principles that I tell the kids, which is we want to try and be ourselves in all conditions. And here we were in a different condition. And I certainly was not being, you know, the coach that I aspire to be most days. And so whenever you're violating your own principles, you're in some big trouble, I think. So, easy way to put it, I probably just relaxed, you know, and just let the players play and just lived with what happened. And what happened was some good stuff.
I was going to ask, do you remember if it made an impact, that change?
Well, we ended up winning, so I have to believe that it made a difference, you know. And you know, you'd have to ask my athletes and maybe Jonathan and Leslie Gabriel who were there in the office with me. But I think for sure there was more of a recommitment to some of the things that we started talking about early in the season, you know, about being ourselves in some really gnarly conditions when, you know, you're playing for a conference title or playing in the tournament.
I checked in with Jonathan before we talked to you, and that was one of the things he mentioned, that you're often very open and vulnerable with your staff and ask the same of them. And I guess I was going to ask what the reason why, but it sounds like that's why you do that. And I'm wondering, I guess, how you kind of are able to create that environment.
Yeah, a little bit of it is a conscious choice, you know, to just make sure people feel like they can say anything at any time. And when people are contributing to your program, whether it's your players or your staff, when they have input, then I think they have ownership. And when they have ownership, they're just going to do an outstanding job, you know. And the joke I always tell with our players, or the thing I always say with our players, is when's the last time you washed a rental car, you know? And that's the that's the real meaning of ownership. You know, nobody washes a rental car, and but if it's your car, you know, you take care of it. And so when people feel ownership in a program, they're just going to give you the best of what they have. And so part of it, I think, is a conscious choice to make sure that there's a just open communication. And then the other half of it might be just many times where I go, hey, I don't know everything. There's no way. And if I did, I'd probably be in big trouble. I've been doing this for 2-3 years. You know, I've been coaching for 15 years, but I've been a head coach at this university for 3 years. I'm not going to sit here and pretend like I know everything, you know. And so maybe those two factors contribute to why, you know, that's an environment that I value.
Do you ever fear, like, you know, with that environment creating uncomfortable conversations and situations?
Yeah, you know, I was someone who, you know, my natural self, I'm not someone who handles awkward situations well. You know, I'm one of those people who, if there's like an awkward situation going on, I sometimes physically distance myself, you know, and so it had to be somewhat of a learned skill, you know, of you're just going to sit in this, you know, and let it pass. And, you know, just you're going to have to sit in this uncomfortable conversation and just keep it going. And once you do that enough times, you know, I think like all skills, you get better at it. And I'm trying to think of some stories that kind of reiterate that point a little bit better for you guys. So here's a story. I think early on in my coaching career, you know, maybe in the first 6 months of taking over at Washington, when I was drinking through a fire hose, as I like to say, a lot of things were in my eyes not going well. You know, I had an athlete fail a class. I had, you know, I think I had a player push a football player into a bush or something. I don't know. I had all these things not going well, you know, and I called either Rob or Marv. I called somebody and I told them all these things that I thought were going wrong. And I had certainly had some feelings that, hey, the players, you know, they're not working as hard as they did when Jim was here. You know, that was probably just my own anxiety. It wasn't a reality. And I told this coach that, and finally, kind of at the end of it, they said, okay, that's, you know, sounds like a lot. You know, you're paid to get bad news, right? And it's a saying that pretty much changed the whole, my whole paradigm on being a head coach, you know, and where's bad news supposed to go? You know, bad news goes up. It doesn't go sideways. You know, if something's not going well, you want your players to come tell you, you know, where else do you want them to go? And so that's a saying that I think has kind of stuck with me. You know, I'm paid to get bad news, and I'm paid to be there on a player's worst day. And, you know, that's probably another value that I try and bring to life.
Nice. And you mentioned that with assistance and people helping out, that skills can be learned. Once you do have your staff in place, what do you do to help develop them?
Yeah. A couple things that I think help in developing your staff. One is, you know, trying to make sure that they're a little bit at the edge of their ability level, you know, and maybe the greatest example of that would be, you know, sometimes when I hire a new staff member, you know, I've hired a new assistant twice now, and you start off in your writing practices, you know, and then in time you ask them to write a portion of practice, and then in time you ask them to write, you know, a larger portion of practice, and then, you know, you get to a point where you say, you know what, this spring season or for the next 6 weeks, you've got all the morning practices, you know, and we need to develop in these areas and let's see what you got. And just kind of make sure that they're a little bit outside where they're comfortable, you know. And then hopefully, you know, for those staff members who've been around for 6 months to a year, you know, kind of asking them questions of, hey, what do you want to get better at, and what aren't you doing that you want to do? And I think those are two things that are a big deal. I don't think people realize how important, you know, when you're a head coach, you pretty much have two teams. You know, you have 13 to 18 players. And at Washington, I think I probably have somewhere close to 12 staff members. You know, it's like you're coaching two teams, and you gotta make them both great.
So I love the idea of getting your coaches to the edge of their abilities. Cause I think it's something we ask of players all the time, but not always something that coaches do. So I'm wondering how you do that for yourself then, if you don't have someone kind of pushing you in that way.
Yeah. How do I push myself? First of all, you got to have people who challenge you. You know, I think Jonathan Winder, you know, my first hire, you know, I told you about his candor, but certainly someone who had a strong opinion in a lot of areas and, you know, would challenge me often. And you, as a head coach, you have to have this appreciation for it, even though it can drive you crazy sometimes, you know, and I would joke with Jonathan at times, I'd say, hey, quit coaching me and go coach the players, you know? And, but that's a big deal, you know, and Leslie Gabriel's the same way, you know, she to me represents someone who has just a long understanding of how to be successful at Washington specifically. She's been there 15 plus years, I think, and has won a national championship, and she's keeps me grounded to some principles that, you know, we know lead to success. I try and say yes to things that I'm not that comfortable with, you know, some coaching clinics. I did a coaching clinic in Canada, did a coaching clinic in Salt Lake City. I've coached the college national team a few years ago. I'm currently at the Olympic Training Center coaching the junior national team. That has been...
You're doing a podcast?
What's that? Yeah, I'm doing a podcast. Podcast with you guys.
You're way outside your comfort zone.
Yeah, certainly not something I'm comfortable with. But my intuition is, wow, I've never done that. I'm going to do it. You know, anytime I find myself saying, yeah, I've got no idea how to do that. Yeah, let's do that. You know, and it kind of just kind of jump in and figure it out. And it's kind of been a little bit of a theme throughout my my coaching career.
So when you have a new hire, a new staff come in, they're, you know, they obviously have had different coaching experiences and maybe see things a different way. How do you get, you know, the staff to be on the same page philosophically? Are there books you use or resources to get, yeah, kind of everyone aligned? Or do you want them aligined?
So this is my second time, you know, when I first got hired, I don't think I was in any way, shape or form ready to kind of organize a staff. Thankfully, a lot of people stayed on board, you know, a lot of the support staff and technical directors and volunteer assistants, all these people were, you know, still on board. And so Jonathan and I were the only two people who were really in new roles. This time around, you know, I think we just had six staff members get, you know, new jobs or full-time positions at other schools. And so this time around, all of a sudden it felt like, okay, I need to get everyone organized here. And so did a couple presentations for the first time ever in my career where we talk about kind of the structure of the staff and here are the things we value. And, you know, these are our responsibilities and have that kind of, you know, just, I don't know, it was an interesting experience for me doing it this time around. There were so many new people that I had to try and get organized. And so that was the route that I went this time around, of just a little more formal presentation, you know, to try and get us all on the same page.
And when you were an assistant coach, if there's something the head coach was doing that maybe you guys didn't see eye to eye on, whether it was just training methods or feedback or something, I guess, how did you approach that? And can you think of any examples?
Yeah, let me think of some examples. The first thing I would say, of course, is pick your battles, you know, pick your battles. And, you know, like I said before, if you're passionate about something, you better be passionate about it all year. And don't just kind of disagree to disagree. What is an example of something? You know, I think one of the things I've noticed with assistant coaches is just this desire to have a bunch of novel drills, a bunch of different drills. You know, that's one of the areas that they come in where they think, hey, let's do serve and pass this way, or let's do this outside hitter competition this way, and let's this number of balls in this many minutes. And what I've realized is it's not about, you know, having a million different drills. It's about, you know, having maybe little variations to one drill so that your athletes aren't thinking about the score or when do I rotate. Because every time you introduce a new drill, it's going to cost you a day. And when I became a head coach, the feeling I generally have is I can't afford to lose a day. No, I can't. We can't spend a day learning this drill and then have it tomorrow. Is this drill that much better than, you know, doing serve and pass this way? If not, then why change it? You know, so that would be, you know, a suggestion to many assistant coaches who are joining programs. You know, just understand the structure of you know, the activity that your coach is doing it and why they do it. And if you can improve it, go for it. If your change doesn't improve it in some significant way, then why bother, you know, make an impact somewhere else. And then, yeah, don't be upset. I think a lot of assistant coaches, they'll bring an idea to the table. It'll get shot down maybe, and they'll get discouraged. And, you know, I know quite a few assistant coaches around the country, and from time to time they'll express frustration. And I just want to tell them, like, hey, keep going. Keep throwing ideas at them. Some will stick, some won't. And that's just the way it is.
Can you give us one of those staple drills? Say if you want to work on serving that day. Can you take us through one?
Yeah, so maybe a seam serve and pass drill is something that we spend a lot of time on. I think serving seams and passing seams is just an area that we want to be great year in and year out. And so maybe we do, you know, we've got two courts, we've got two passers on each court and some servers serving at them. And we're going to do 4 3-minute rounds, you know, and we're serving and passing, and we're talking about communication, we're talking about seam responsibilities, maybe we're talking about mechanics. We can change what we talk about each day based on where we think we're not good. But, you know, then maybe a coach says, well, you know, what can we serve, you know, out of 10, see how many we get out of 10? Can we serve two in a row, one passer? Can we, you know, can we put three passers out there? Can we have them pass half the court? And just, you know, it's serving and passing, and we're serving seams and we're passing seams. And, you know, our feedback is more important than the structure of how we get, you know, this number of balls into the seam. You know, it's just, it's not that complicated. You know, let's just roll this thing out and let's go. You know, let's be great about what we tell our athletes with our feedback, and that's it. So maybe that's the best example I can give. But there's lots of other examples, you know, in wash drills. You know, there's a ton of different ways you can score a wash drill. And, you know, from day to day, I just think I like running the same practice maybe 2 days in a row. Maybe, you know, having a hitter tournament that lasts 2 days, you know, so that by the second day the athletes are just moving through it seamlessly, and they have just zero mental effort to how the drill scored or run, and all of their focus is on how they move and what they see and how they communicate.
I like that. So the drill stays the same, but it's more the area that the coaches are giving feedback on, that, or maybe the specific focus, that's what changes more often.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's where the magic's at, you know. And, you know, hey, today we're going to change speeds on you, going back to that seam serve and pass. And passers, we got to see the speed of the serve. We got to see the arm of the server. We got to move up on it, you know, and that's the feedback. And so you have this same activity with a tiny variation, you know, and your servers are back there changing their speeds pretty consciously. And that to me would be a good example of making a variation. You don't need to write up some other new number of rounds or things like that.
That was part one with Keegan Cook. He's back next week, and we hit him with some hard listener questions. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Coach Your Brains Out, the show that explores learning from the top minds in volleyball and beyond. With your hosts, John Mayer, Billy Allen, Andrew Fuller, and Nils Nielsen.
So we have a bunch of listener questions. We have one more that's on assistant coaches, and then we've got some random ones.
Okay.
So the last assistant coach kind of question is from Ben Lee, who is a current assistant coach for the indoor staff at Loyola Marymount. He says, if you could go back in time and mentor or advise your younger self as an assistant coach, what areas would you advise to learn or engage in more to help you prepare for a head coaching position?
Ben Lee coming in with a challenging question.
It's an easy one.
What would I do differently as an assistant coach to better?
Basically, how are you? How would you prepare yourself, like, to be ready to be a head coach? Or were there things you would have done differently along the way to when you were an assistant?
I'll come back. I don't want to disregard Ben's question. I think back a lot to why some of the things I did as an assistant that I think helped me as a head coach. So I'll start there with what I think, looking back, I think I did well. And the first thing I think is I head coached a club team for about 10 years, and it wasn't the highest level club team, but head coaching is head coaching, and writing practices is writing practices, and communicating with parents is communicating with parents. And those skills are very specific to being in that role. And so, it was a pretty tough time, working at St. Mary's and then at night going to coach club, sometimes coaching two teams from 8 to 10 and then doing it all over again. But that's one thing that I'm glad I did, just being a head coach. One thing that I'm thankful for now that I probably wasn't thankful for back when it was happening. And I just have to throw Rob under the bus here. He would go to the Olympics all the time. Everyone wants to hang out with Rob. He would go to the Olympics and he would always go, of course, during summer camp. So there were several times where I had to run summer camp, and that's a skill. Being a clinician is a skill, and leading a summer camp and leading demos and organizing a staff and, dealing with complaints. Those are skills. And what I realize now is what a gift, Rob gave me to be gone. And, I think 1 year the Olympics actually extended through August. So he missed part of training camp and he let me and our other assistant, design training camp. So just those were things that I think really helped prepare me for being a head coach one day, is just doing very specific head coach things, no matter what the level was, just head coaching's head coaching. Things I would do differently. Ooh, that's a tough question. I think expose myself to a variety of different systems and programs. The organizations that I was a part of were all pretty closely aligned with how they teach the game and the language they speak. And I was very fortunate to work for two incredible coaches, who are just so good at what they do and know the game at such a high level. They share some similar principles, and I really wish I could see how other programs run, other programs that I'm now competing against, programs like Florida and Wisconsin, Texas, Michigan. I really wish I had an understanding of what they're great at and where they spend their time. That to me would just be gold, And so if I had a little more diversity in the programs that I spent time around, that's the one thing I wish coaches had. I wish we had like a coaching sabbatical where we could just take a semester off and fly to other gyms. And a lot of great coaches I know do that from time to time. They visit other gyms. I know I try to, but I could have done it as an assistant. It's a lot easier as an assistant to do that.
Nice. This one's from Eric Barber. At the University of Washington, you have created a culture where players feel comfortable coming into the office to share their opinions or concerns. What steps have you taken to create this culture?
Thanks, Eric. Eric is our assistant beach coach and has worked for us for a couple years and played at UC San Diego. Great person. Someone who I actually hired, I think, after a 10-minute interview, but character. Just when you're talking about hires, character is a big deal. But to answer his question, when you get that bad news, when a player walks into your office and hits you with something heavy, I think the best thing you can do is to not react initially. And so the story that comes to mind, which is a really difficult story at the time, was, in my first year, I had an athlete walk into my office and say, I'm not, things aren't going well. I said, I know things aren't going well. You're, you're failing this class, you're not playing very well, you know, it's not, I'm not really enjoying coaching right now. And she said, I'm just having a hard time. I don't respect you as much as I should. You know, I came here to play for Jim and he's gone now and I'm just having a hard time. And it was really painful to hear that. You know, this is a player that I had invested a tremendous amount of time in, a player who was making some mistakes and I wasn't crushing her. You know, I was standing by her and here she was hitting me with that comment, you know, and I just just heard it. And I just let the initial reaction, the emotion pass. And I said, okay, well, I'll see you at practice later. And the funny part about it was, you know, I told someone that that happened and they said, oh yeah, players just say that to me all the time. You know, they would say that all the time. And once I heard that, once I heard that it wasn't me and that, that kids are kids and it's the equivalent of, you know, a small child walking up and telling their mom, I hate you. You know, they don't really hate them. They're just having a hard time and they're lashing out, you know. And so to not react, I think, makes it better the next time. The next time that player walks in the office, they know that no matter what they tell you, you're with them. You know, you may not be happy. You may have to have some consequences, but you're still with them, you know. And, you know, the other half of that story is that that player went on to just do amazing things. We have a great relationship now, you know, and I could have totally screwed that up in that moment. You know, I could have reacted and said, well, then get out of here. Here's your release papers. Have a great career. You know, I could have reacted. And so that would be something that I think helps contribute to a culture of openness.
Nice. And Eric's follow-up, in situations where a player might not be leaving with the resolution they want, how do you attempt to get them to walk out the door feeling the conversation was successful?
Yeah. If they came into your office to talk, it's successful, first of all. You know, if they have a problem, if they came in, you've already won to some degree. And what I tell them and what I tell myself is, you may not leave with the answer you want, but you'll certainly feel a lot better when you walk out of this office than you walked in, you know. And another principle we talk about is problems don't age well, you know. And when things are inside of our head and they ruminate and they spin around, they just become just this unstoppable force, you know. And you can really convince yourself of some crazy things if you think about it long enough, you know. You can really it's like a habit. Is what, you know, your thoughts or habits. That's something that Jim would talk about, and I didn't fully understand it until years later. Just, you know, if you let a thought spin around over and over and over again, it'll turn into something gnarly. You know, good thoughts turn into good things, you know, and bad thoughts can just rip you apart. So getting them out is the first thing you got to do.
I like that. So Rob Browning, another listener, the head coach at St. Mary's, he asks, what are some reliable indicators of good team culture? And what do you like to see from your team that tells you our team culture is good?
Well, here's one thing I really hear a lot that I disagree with. Coaches and teams will say, and, you know, this isn't news to Rob, I think I brought this up to him, but maybe it is for listeners, you know, they'll say, hey, we've got great team chemistry. Yeah, we get along. We never have any issues. And I kind of laugh and I say, that's not team chemistry. That's team harmony, you know? And when you think about chemistry, what is chemistry? It's kind of this violent, you know, action, reaction, neutralizers, catalysts, you know, just balancing. It's just, there's things happening. It's not this kind of peaceful, tranquil process. And so there has to be some things happening. You have to have some players who are trying to motivate the group. You have to have some players who are steady, you know, in their approach to the game. You have to have some players who just give unconditionally to their team. So having just a diverse roles on your team, I think, is really powerful, you know, and trying to help your players understand what their individual strengths are as leaders, and encouraging them to, you know, to do more of the thing that they're great at, you know, I think is something that I've gotten pretty passionate about when it comes to team culture. So it's the right kind of conflict, you know, there's a certain healthy level of conflict that you have to pay close attention to. There's other indicators, you know, eye contact, you know, in between rallies, you know, the sincerity in which players talk to each other, you know, that's one thing that I've been trying to talk about with this junior national team is most of what they say to each other is totally scripted. It's not sincere. It's not unique to the situation. You know, they'll say things like the score is 11-11. They'll say things like, come on, let's push to 12, you know, or just come on, we got to give more energy right now. Just these kind of scripted things that coaches have told them that they're supposed to say, you know, and they have nothing to do with the play. You know, there'll be plays where someone will whack it out of bounds, or someone will get tooled, or someone will miss a dig, and someone will say, good touch, good touch. And I'll look at them and I say, what are you talking about? Well, that is the most insincere feedback you could ever give her. She just made a bad play. Why are you telling her good job? You know, but the thing is, they're just going off script. And I think when you watch, you know, our women's national team, or, you know, the closest version I have to that is Courtney Thompson has come by our gym for an alumni game, and just the sincerity in which she talks to her teammates, you know, and she's really specific about what she says to them, and it's totally accurate to what just happened. You know, I think that is the sign of somebody who's really contributing to your team chemistry.
And then what are indicators of a bad team culture? Is it too much harmony?
It can be. Yeah. You know, it can be. Long silences, lack of eye contact, overly aggressive conflict, you know, but there's warning signs before you get there. It's about paying really close attention to your athletes. You know, if you pay really close attention to kind of their day-to-day approach to the game, you notice the differences. And when you notice the differences, you got to, you know, in the right moment, ask them, hey, what's going on? You know, I think a lot of coaches fail to realize that most of the worst behaviors come from a place of just fear. You know, almost every time I have an athlete who's kind of off in left field with their behavior, there's something going on and they just haven't told me yet. The last thing I would say that I would really want coaches to know is I hear coaches say, you need to call her out. You need to call your teammates out when they're not behaving the way we want them to behave. And I think it's such a dangerous phrase. The reality of the situation is that athlete's already out. Their behavior has pulled them out of the group. You need to bring them back. You know, you need to bring them back into the group. And so that's what I would want to tell my athlete. Hey, you got to bring her back. You know, she's having a hard time right now. You got to bring her back in the group, not call her out. There's this kind of image in my mind of, you know, your senior captain, you know, calling a freshman out, you know, into, you know, onto an island saying, you know, hey, go stand over here. You're not with us, you know, and just that image of kind of ostracizing that person that I don't think contributes to good team chemistry. You know?
So then how would Courtney Thompson bring that player back?
Ooh. I'm not going to speak for Courtney Thompson.
can't do it in her voice?
No, I don't have nearly the energy or the skill or the passion to do anything like that. But I know she's got courage. You know, I know she's got the courage to have the hard conversation. And she might screw it up. You know, I think she tells a story about screwing it up, you know, where she, you know, tried to tell some teammates they weren't doing it right. And she was totally wrong. She was totally wrong in the way that she did it, but it eventually worked itself out. And as it usually does, the first step is you got to go for it. Better to make a mistake going for it than to, you know, just not try and address it.
Right. So I have two more from Rob. He says, how do you use consequences to motivate or teach your team?
Um, We don't run a lot. We never run or do physical consequences for performance-based things. You know, hey, we, you know, if we're going to do a coach on one or we're going to do a touch six, it's going to be for effort, for communication, for not treating a teammate the way that we agreed to treat each other. Those things, I think, you know, are met with, hey, we're just going to run here. You know, we can't, you know, you can't do that. Just let's just run for a while. Or, hey, I think I did what I thought was a pretty mild coach on one compared to, you know, what I've heard from Marv Gumpy, you know, but my players have remembered it forever. You know, we had a couple of athletes, I think, who got a noise complaint, you know, and got written up for it. And so we did a coach on one on Monday, and, you know, I think it was like a 2-minute coach on one, and they were pretty tired. And, I didn't think it was that intense, but they'll remember that forever. So consequences to me, you know, there's consequences in life. There's just some things you can't do. At some point you get to an age, you know what? You can't do that anymore. Sorry. You know? And so maybe that's the place for consequences. But yeah, when it comes to competition, winning and losing, just, yeah, we like winning because we like winning, not because we don't want to not run.
All right, last one from Rob. How do you balance positive and negative feedback?
I just, the word I always come back to is I want to be sincere. I really want to be sincere. I'm not going to qualify my feedback into positive and negative. I'm going to qualify it as what I'm telling you right now is what I believe to be exactly what you need to be who you want to be and do what you want to do. And one thing that Jim used to say that I really value now more than ever is the truth hurts, but people can handle it. The truth hurts, but people can handle it. And he's right. These women are more resilient than we give them credit for. They can handle more than, you know, than often we can even imagine. And if what you're telling them comes from a sincere place and it's done in a respectful way, it can be negative feedback that's respectful or, you know, positive feedback, then they'll respond. You know, they'll respond and they can handle it and then they'll grow from it. If it comes from a place of your own personal frustration or your own anxiety or, you know, then it's not going to go well. And, so where is your feedback coming from? You know, and whenever my feedback comes from a place of frustration, it never goes well, you know, and it's a battle all the time, you know, but, I think that's an important thing to ask yourself as a coach, you know. I steal all of these guys' sayings. I think Marv has a saying of you can't kid a kid, you know, you can fool a fool, you can fool yourself, but you can't kid a kid, you know, they're smart. They are so smart and they know when you really care about them or when you're just angry.
So if Billy's been struggling all practice and you're giving him some negative feedback and it's been kind of a more negative in general, are you looking for an opportunity to kind of pump him up and give him some positive at some point, or it's just keep it honest?
I think they see right through that, you know. You can try and be sincere, but, you know, we've all seen that, right? You're on some kid and then they make like a marginally good play and you try and pump them up. And I think maybe a better question that I try and ask a lot, especially when I've been on an athlete for a while, you know, if I've given them a lot of feedback and I start to sense that frustration before I go in for that next piece of feedback, I say to them, hey, can I coach you right now? Can I coach you? Are you good to get some feedback? And 9 times out of 10, they say, yeah, you know, but sometimes they don't. Sometimes they say, hey, I needed to kind of do my thing. And I think that's really important, you know, knowing when to give your athlete space, you know, is a skill as well, as opposed to just kind of riding them all the way into the ground.
So we have one more that's kind of on culture, and it's from the head coach at Fresno State, Jonathan Winder, who we've already mentioned, a former teammate of mine. And I think you've kind of answered this, but maybe this will help us kind of tie it all together. He says, what skills and what cultural values have led to the consistency in performance of your teams?
I'm still with you. I'm just, these guys are crushing me with these really hard questions. What are some of the big values that have led to consistent performance? I don't think that I like to believe that every coaching decision that I've made is in the best interest of the team, and that they're, you know, the athletes at times may feel like, man, he's so hard on her right now, or he's going easy on her. But if you ask them at the end of the year, did you make all the right moves at the right time? You know, does anyone have a case to say, I should have had a bigger role, or I should have been playing at this time? Does anyone have a case? I think they're going to say no. You know, I think they're going to say no. You know what? Given everything that was going on, that decision you made was the right one, and it was objective, and it didn't matter what the circumstance was with that player. That was the right choice. So being objective with your decision making, I think, is you know, and being committed to that, you know, is, you know, a really important factor in being successful. Again, spreading out the load amongst your staff, giving people ownership, letting them, trusting them to take large responsibilities that are very, very critical to your success, doesn't mean that you just delegate and then walk away, but that you really let them know that they get to make the decisions. You ask their opinions, you know, and you just watch what they can do with it, you know. And the great coaches I've worked for have allowed me to do that. They allowed me as an assistant to take portions of the game and to own it and to make some decisions that affected the team tremendously, you know. And so I try and, you know, again, follow that same principle. You know, you cannot do it on your own. Nobody accomplishes greatness alone. And so you gotta divvy it up.
Nice.
That's maybe two things.
Yeah. And listener Kevin McCullough wants to know what you think is the most important skill in volleyball. John says reading. Kevin says it's attitude. What do you say?
Wow, skill is a pretty broad term. Reading. No one said serving. Man, serving is a really big deal. I don't know. I keep drifting between skills and values.
Right.
You know,
right.
I my mind keeps saying resiliency. You know, being resilient is just so crucial. You know, just how many athletes I've worked with who've been through just the gnarliest circumstances, and just think it's just shown me that being resilient is the deal. You're gonna get just knocked back in thousand different ways, but usually in one or two big moments you're just gonna get crushed, and are you resilient? You know, do you come back again the next day and get through it? Give me some examples again. What were the answers? They said reading. What else?
Kevin says attitude. I like resiliency.
Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I'm gonna stick with that. I think that's something that just every player on my team has a story that I usually know. They don't even know about each other sometimes. If they did, they might even respect each other even more if they knew, you know, just what each of them have been through. So resiliency.
All right. And I got these, compared to this one, they've all been easy questions. So I got a tough one to end it.
Ooh, this is tough.
Listener Ian says you were an amazing snowblader in college. Did you ever consider going pro? I had to look up what that was.
What's a snowblader?
Yeah, it's like these short skis that unathletic people. No, that's what I was athletic. People who can't snowboard use. Yeah, no, I'm strictly twin tip alpine skis now. That's my December activity. You know, after the season's over, I head up to Whistler, and you know, that's my happy place. So
he was saying all the cool guys in Colorado hadn't really picked it up yet.
Yeah, no, when you're the only one with them, it should tell you something. You're either a pioneer
or not. You're ahead of the trends.
The trend that never became anything yet.
It's coming.
Cool. Well, thanks so much for spending time with us.
Yeah, I'm sweating profusely. You guys just put me through the ringer. So.
Hey, you said you wanted to be challenged tonight.
Yeah.
I was worried. I didn't know if we'd be able to, but I think we got some good ones in there.
Yeah, no, it was great. It's always good to have these experiences. Thank you guys for the time at night, too. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for doing this. It was great. A lot of good insights, and appreciate you being so open and vulnerable.
Thanks for listening to another episode of Coach Your Brains Out. You can follow us on Twitter at Coach Your Brain or on Facebook, facebook.com/Coach Your Brains Out. If you like the show, please write us a review and spread the word.